quickly but coordinate beautifully, one complimenting the other. Madame Padva greets them with the practiced disinterest she reserves for pretty young things, but warms when they enthusiastically compliment her hair and jewels and dress. Mr. Barris finds himself somewhat smitten with both of them, though it might be the wine. He has a fair amount of difficulty understanding their heavy Scottish accents, if they are Scottish at all. He is not entirely sure. The last guest arrives shortly before dinner, just as the rest of the guests are being seated and the wine is being poured. He is a tall man of indeterminate age with indistinct features. He wears a spotless grey suit with tails and gives his top hat and cane at the door and a card with the name Mr. A. H. He nods politely at the other guests as he sits, but says nothing. Chandras joins them at this point, followed closely by his assistant, Marco, a handsome young man with striking green eyes who quickly attracts the attention of both Burgess sisters.
"I have invited you all here for a reason," Chandras says, "as I'm sure you have surmised by now. However, it is a business matter, and I find those to be best discussed on a full stomach. So we shall save the official discourse for after dessert."
He waves vaguely at one of the waiters, and as the clock in the hall begins to chime a low, heavy sound that reverberates throughout the house 12 times, the first course is brought out. The conversation is as pleasant and flowing as the wine over the subsequent courses. The ladies are more talkative than the men. In fact, the man in the grey suit barely says a word. And though few of them have met before, by the time the plats principaux are cleared, an observer would have thought that they had known each other for ages. When dessert is finished a few minutes before 2 o'clock in the morning, Chandras stands and clears his throat.
"If you would all be so kind as to join me in the study for coffee and brandy, we may get down to business," he says.
He nods at Marco, who slips away, rejoining them upstairs in the study with several large notebooks and rolls of paper in hand. Coffees and brandies are poured, and the guests settle on various couches and armchairs around the crackling fireplace. After lighting a cigar, Chandras begins his speech, punctuating it with purposefully placed puffs of smoke.
"Your company has been requested this evening because I have a project I am beginning, an endeavour, you might say. I do believe it is an endeavour that will appeal to all of you, and that you may, each in your unique ways, aid in the planning. Your assistance, which is entirely voluntary, will be both appreciated and well compensated," he says. "Stop beating around the bush and tell us what your new game is, Chandras, darling," Madame Padva says, swirling her brandy. "Some of us aren't getting any younger."
One of the Burgess sisters stifles a giggle.
"But of course, Tant Padva," Chandras bows in her direction, "my new game, as you so appropriately call it, is a circus." "A circus?" says Lainey Burgess with a smile. "How marvellous!" "Like a carnival?" Mr. Barris asks, sounding mildly confused. "More than a carnival," Chandras says. "More than a circus, really. Like no circus anyone has ever seen. Not a single large tent, but a multitude of tents, each with a particular exhibition. No elephants or clowns, no. Something more refined than that. Nothing commonplace. This will be different. This will be an utterly unique experience, a feast for the senses. Theatrics on theatre, an immersive entertainment. We will destroy the presumptions and preconceived notions of what a circus is and make it something else entirely, something new."
He gestures at Marco, who spreads out the rolls of paper on the table, holding down the corners with an assortment of paperweights and oddities, a monkey skull, a butterfly suspended in glass. The plans are predominantly sketches surrounded by notes. They show only fragments of ideas, a ring of tents, a central promenade. Lists of possible attractions or acts are scrawled down the sides, some crossed out or circled. Fortune teller, acrobats, conjurer, contortionists, dancers, fire artists. The Burgess sisters and Mr. Barris pore over the sketches, reading each note as Chandrish continues. Madame Padva smiles but remains seated, sipping her brandy. Mr. A.H. does not move, his expression inscrutable and unchanged.
It is merely in conceptual stages, and that is why I ask you all here now for the inception and development. What it needs is style, panache, ingenuity in its engineering and structure, to be infused with the mesmerizing and perhaps a touch of mystery. I believe you are the proper group for this undertaking. If any of you disagree, you are welcome to leave, but I respectfully request you speak of this to no one. I prefer that these plans be kept undisclosed entirely, at least for now. Very sensitive at this point, after all.
He takes a long draw off his cigar, blowing out the smoke slowly before he concludes,
If we do things properly, it will undoubtedly take on a life of its own.
There is silence when he finishes. Only the crackle of the fire fills the room for several moments as the guests look from one to the other, each waiting for someone to respond.
Might I have a pencil?
Mr. Barris asks. Marco hands him one, and Mr. Barris begins drawing, taking the rudimentary sketch of the circus's layout and developing it into a complex design. Chandrish's guests remain there until just before dawn, and when they do finally depart, there are three times the number of diagrams and plans and notes than there had been when they arrived, strewn and pinned around the study like maps to an unknown treasure. Condolences. New York, March 1885. The announcement in the papers states that Hector Bowen, better known as Prospero the Enchanter, entertainer and stage magician of great renown, died of heart failure in his home on the 15th of March. It goes on about his work and his legacy for some time. The age listed is erroneous, a detail few readers perceive. A short paragraph at the end of the obituary mentions that he is survived by a daughter of 17 years of age, a Miss Celia Bowen. This number is more accurate. There is also a notice that though the funeral services will be private, condolences may be sent via the address of one of the local theatres. The cards and letters are collected, placed in bags, and brought by messenger to the Bowens' private residence, a townhouse that is already overflowing with appropriately somber floral arrangements. The scent of lilies is stifling, and when Celia can no longer tolerate it, she transforms all of the flowers into roses. Celia leaves the condolences piled on the dining room table until they begin to overflow into the lounge. She does not want to deal with them, but she cannot bring herself to toss them away unread. When she is unable to avoid the matter further, she makes a pot of tea and begins to tackle the mountains of paper. She opens each piece of mail one by one and sorts them into piles. There are postmarks from around the globe. There are long, earnest letters filled with genuine despair. There are empty well-wishes and hollow praises of her father's talents. Many of them comment that the senders were unaware that the great Prospero had a daughter. Others remember her fondly, describing a delightful tiny girl that Celia herself does not recall being. A few include disturbingly worded marriage proposals. Those in particular Celia crumples into balls, placing the crushed missives on her open palm one by one and concentrating until they burst into flame, leaving nothing but cinders on her hand that she brushes away into nothingness. "I am already married," she remarks to the empty air, twisting the ring on her right hand that covers an old distinctive scar. Amongst the letters and cards there is a plain grey envelope. Celia pulls it from the pile, slicing it open with a silver letter opener, ready to throw it on the pile with the rest. But this envelope, unlike the others, is addressed to her father proper, though the postmark is after his date of death. The card inside is not a note of sympathy nor a condolence for her loss. It contains no greeting, no signature. The handwritten words across the paper read, "Your move," and nothing more. Celia turns the card over, but the reverse is blank. Not even a stationer's imprint marring the surface. There is no return address upon the envelope. She reads the two words on the grey paper several times. She cannot tell if the feeling creeping up her spine is excitement or dread. Abandoning the remaining condolences, Celia takes the card in hand and leaves the room, ascending a winding stair that leads to the upstairs parlour. She pulls a ring of keys from her pocket and impatiently unlocks three separate locks in order to access the room that is drenched in bright afternoon sun. "What is this about?" Celia says, holding the card out in front of her as she enters. The figure hovering by the window turns. Where the sunlight hits him, he is all but invisible. Part of a shoulder appears to be missing. The top of his head vanishes in a flutter of sun-caught dust. The rest of him is transparent, like a reflection in glass. What is left of Hector Bowen reads the note and laughs delightedly. The Contortionist's Tattoo. London, September 1885. Approximately once a month, there are not quite regularly scheduled midnight dinners that are most often referred to by the guests as circus dinners. They are a nocturnal amalgam of social event and business meeting. Madame Padva is always in attendance, and one or both Burgess sisters are a staple. Mr. Barris joins them as often as his schedule will allow, as he travels quite a bit and is not as flexible as he would prefer. Mr. A.H. appears rarely. Tara remarks that they seem to have more productive post-dinner meetings when he is there, though he offers only occasional suggestions as to how the circus itself should be regulated. On this particular evening, only the ladies are present.
"Where is our Mr. Barris this evening?" Madame Padva inquires after the Burgess sisters arrive on their own, since he commonly accompanies them. "He's in Germany," Lainey and Tara chorus in perfect unison, making Chandrish laugh as he hands them their glasses of wine.
"He's tracking down a clockmaker," Lainey continues solo. "Something about commissioning a piece for the circus. He was quite enthused about it before he left."
Tonight's dinner has no scheduled entertainment, not even the standard piano accompaniment, but entertainment arrives unannounced at the door nonetheless. She gives her name as Tsukiko, though she does not clarify if it is her first or last name. She is small, but not tiny. Long midnight black hair is artfully knotted in elaborate braids upon her head. She wears a dark coat that is too large for her, but she carries herself in such a way that it seems to hang like a cloak, and the effect is rather elegant. Marco leaves her in the foyer, waiting patiently beneath the looming gold elephant-headed statue, while he attempts to explain the situation to Chandresh, which of course results in the entire dinner company filing out into the hall to see what the fuss is about.
"What brings you here at this hour?"
Chandresh asks, perplexed. Stranger things have happened at La Maison Lefebvre than unexpected entertainment, and the pianist does sometimes send a replacement when she is unavailable for a dinner.
"I have always been nocturnal," is Tsukiko's only response,
and she does not elaborate as to what twists of fate brought her to this spot at this time, but the smile that accompanies her cryptic sentiment is warm and contagious. The Burgess sisters beg Chandresh to let her stay.
"We are about to sit down to dinner,"
Chandresh says with a frown.
"But you are welcome to join us in the dining room to do whatever it is you do."
Tsukiko bows, and the smile appears again. While the rest of them file into the dining room, Marco takes her coat, hesitating when he sees what lies beneath it. She wears a thin wisp of a gown that would likely be considered scandalous in other company, but this gathering is not easily scandalized.
It is more a delicate swathe of red silk held in place by a tightly laced corset than a proper dress. And it is not the relative insubstantiality of her clothing that causes Marco to stare, but the tattoo that snakes across her skin. At first it is difficult to discern what it is, the shower of black marks that curls around her shoulder and neck, ending just above her cleavage in the front and disappearing behind the laces of her corset in the back. It is impossible to tell how far beyond that the tattoo travels. And upon a closer look, it can be discerned that the swirl of the tattoo is more than simple black marks. It is a flowing waterfall of alchemical and astrological symbols, ancient marks for planets and elements, all emblazoned in black ink upon her fair skin. Mercury, lead, antimony, a crescent moon sits at the nape of her neck, an Egyptian ankh near her collarbone. There are other symbols as well, Norse runes, Chinese characters. There are countless tattoos, and yet they meld and flow into one design gracefully adorning her like an elegant, unusual piece of jewelry. Tsukiko catches Marco staring, and though he does not inquire about it, she says quietly, "It is part of who I was, who I am, and who I will be." And then she smiles and walks into the dining room, leaving Marco alone in the hall, just as the clock begins chiming midnight and the first course is served. She slips off her shoes by the doorway and walks barefoot to an area near the piano that is catching the best light from the candelabras and the chandeliers. At first, she simply stands relaxed and calm while the diners regard her curiously, and then it becomes immediately clear what her style of entertainment is. Tsukiko is a contortionist. Traditionally, contortionists are either front-bending or back-bending, depending on the flexibility of their respective spines, and their tricks and performances are based upon this distinction. Tsukiko, however, is one of the rare contortionists whose flexibility is equal in both directions. She moves with the grace of a trained ballerina, a detail Madame Padva notes and mentions in a whisper to the Burgess sisters, even before the more impressive feats of agility begin.
"Could you do such things when you were a dancer?"
Tara asks her, as Tsukiko pulls a leg up impossibly far over her head.
"I would have had a much busier social calendar if I could,"
Madame Padva replies with a shake of her head. Tsukiko is a consummate performer. She adds the perfect flourishes, holds positions and pauses for the ideal amounts of time. Although she twists her body into unimaginable and painful-looking positions, her beatific smile remains in place. Her modest audience forgets their conversation and their dinner as they watch. Lainey remarks to her sister after the fact that she was certain there was music, though there is no sound at all save for the rustle of silk against skin and the crackle from the fireplace.
"This is what I've been talking about," Chandrish says, hitting the table with his fist, suddenly breaking the charmed silence.
Tara nearly drops the fork that she has been holding idly in her hand, catching it before it clatters onto her plate of half-eaten vermouth poached oysters. But Tsukiko continues her graceful motions unfazed, though her smile increases noticeably.
"This?"
Madame Padva asks.
"This,"
Chandresh repeats, waving at Tsukiko.
"This is the precise flavor that the circus should be. Unusual, yet beautiful. Provocative while remaining elegant. This is Kismet, her coming here tonight. We simply have to have her. I will not accept anything less. Marco, get this lady a chair."
A place is set for Tsukiko. Her smile is bemused as she joins them at the table. The conversation that follows involves more creative coercion than outright job offer, and there are several deviations into the subjects of the ballet, modern fashion, and Japanese mythology. After five courses and a great deal of wine, Tsukiko allows herself to be persuaded to accept an invitation to perform in a not-yet-existent circus.
"Well then,"
Chandrish says,
We are set as far as contortionists go. That's a start.
Shouldn't there be more than one?
Lainey asks.
An entire tent, like the one for the acrobats?
Nonsense,
Chandrish replies.
Better to have a single, perfect diamond than a sack of flawed stones. We'll make a showcase of her, put her in the courtyard or something.
The matter is considered settled for the moment, and throughout dessert and after-dinner drinks, the only subject discussed is the circus itself. Tsukiko leaves a card providing information as to how to contact her with Marco as she departs, and she soon becomes a fixture at the circus dinners, often performing before or after dinner, so as not to distract the guests during the meal. She remains Chandresh's favorite, oft-referenced criterion for what the circus should be. Horology. Munich, 1885. Herr Friedrich Thiessen receives an unexpected visitor in his Munich workshop, an Englishman by the name of Mr. Ethan Barris. Mr. Barris admits that he has been attempting to track him down for some time after admiring several Thiessen-crafted cuckoo clocks and was pointed in the right direction by a local shopkeeper. Mr. Barris inquires as to whether Herr Thiessen would be interested in making a special commissioned piece. Herr Thiessen has a constant stream of custom work and tells Mr. Barris as much, indicating a shelf of variants on the traditional cuckoo clock that range from simple to ornate.
I'm not certain you understand, Herr Thiessen, Mr. Barris says. This would be a showcase piece, a curiosity. Your clocks are impressive, but what I am requesting would be something truly outstanding, das Meisterwerk. And money is absolutely no object.
Intrigued now, Herr Thiessen asks for specifications and details. He is given very little. Some constraints as to size, but still rather large, and it is to be painted solely in black and white and shades of grey. Beyond that, the construction and embellishment is up to him. Artistic license, Mr. Barris says. Dreamlike is the only descriptive word he uses specifically. Herr Thiessen agrees, and the men shake hands. Mr. Barris says he will be in touch. And a few days later, an envelope is delivered containing an excessive amount of money, a requested date of completion some months away, and an address in London for the completed clock to be shipped to. It takes the better part of those months for Herr Thiessen to complete the clock. He works on little else, though the sum of money involved makes that arrangement more than manageable. Weeks are spent on the design and mechanics. He hires an assistant to complete some of the basic woodwork, but he takes care of all the details himself. Herr Thiessen loves details, and he loves a challenge. He balances the entire design on that one specific word Mr. Barris used, dreamlike. The finished clock is resplendent. At first glance, it is simply a clock, a rather large black clock, with a white face and a silver pendulum. Well-crafted, obviously, with intricately carved woodwork edges and a perfectly painted face, but just a clock. But that is before it is wound, before it begins to tick, the pendulum swinging steadily and evenly, then it becomes something else. The changes are slow. First, the color changes in the face, shifts from white to gray, and then there are clouds that float across it, disappearing when they reach the opposite side. Meanwhile, bits of the body of the clock expand and contract, like pieces of a puzzle, as though the clock is falling apart slowly and gracefully. All of this takes hours. The face of the clock becomes a darker grey, and then black, with twinkling stars where the numbers had been previously. The body of the clock, which has been methodically turning itself inside out and expanding, is now entirely subtle shades of white and grey. And it is not just pieces, it is figures and objects, perfectly carved flowers and planets, and tiny books with actual paper pages that turn.
there is a silver dragon that curls around part of the now visible clockwork, a tiny princess in a carved tower who paces in distress, awaiting an absent prince. Teapots that pour into teacups, and minuscule curls of steam that rise from them as the seconds tick. Wrapped presents open. Small cats chase small dogs. An entire game of chess is played. At the center, where a cuckoo bird would live in a more traditional timepiece, is the juggler. Dressed in harlequin style with a grey mask, he juggles shiny silver balls that correspond to each hour. As the clock chimes, another ball joins the rest, until at midnight, he juggles 12 balls in a complex pattern. After midnight, the clock begins once more to fold in upon itself. The face lightens, and the clouds return. The number of juggled balls decreases until the juggler himself vanishes. By noon, it is a clock again, and no longer a dream. A few weeks after it is shipped, he receives a letter from Mr. Barris, offering his sincere thanks and marveling at the ingenuity of it. "It is perfection," he writes. The letter is accompanied by another exorbitant amount of money, enough for Herr Thiessen to retire comfortably if he wished. He does not, and continues to make his clocks in his Munich workshop. He thinks no more of it, other than a passing thought of how the clock itself might be doing, and where it might be, though he assumes, incorrectly, that it remains in London. Particularly when he is working on a clock that reminds him of the Wunschtown clock, which was how he referred to it during the more troublesome parts of its construction, uncertain whether or not it was a dream that could be realized. He does not hear from Mr. Barris beyond that single letter. Auditory. London, April 1886. There is an unprecedented gathering of illusionists in the lobby of the theatre. A gaggle of pristine suits and strategically placed silk handkerchiefs. Some have trunks and capes, others carry bird cages or silver-topped canes. They do not speak to each other as they wait to be called in, one at a time, referenced not by name, given or stage, but by a number written on a small slip of paper given to them upon arrival. Instead of chit-chatting or gossiping or sharing tricks of the trade, they shift in their seats and cast rather conspicuous glances at the girl. A few mistook her for an assistant when they arrived, but she sits waiting in her chair with her own numbered slip of paper, 23. She has no trunk, no cape, no birdcage or cane. She is dressed in a deep green gown with a black puff-sleeve jacket buttoned over it. A pile of brown curls is pinned neatly upon her head under a tiny and feathered, but otherwise unremarkable, black hat. Her face maintains a semblance of girlishness in the length of her eyelashes and the slight pout of her lips, despite the fact that she is clearly too old to be properly called a girl. But it is difficult to discern her age, and no one dares inquire. The others think of her as the girl, regardless, and refer to her as such when they discuss the affair after the fact. She acknowledges no one despite the barely concealed glances and occasional outright stare. One by one, each illusionist's number is called by a man with a list and a notebook, who escorts them through a gilded door on the side of the lobby, and, one by one, each returns to the lobby and exits the theatre. Some last only minutes, while others remain in the theatre for quite some time. Those with higher numbers shift impatiently in their seats as they wait for the man with a notebook to reappear and politely call out the number on their respective slips of paper. The last illusionist to enter the gilded door, a rotund fellow with a top hat and flashy cape, returns to the lobby rather quickly and visibly agitated, flouncing through the exit back onto the street, letting the theatre doors slam shut behind him. The sound is still echoing through the lobby when the man with the notebook reappears, nods absently at the room, and clears his throat. "Number 23, Marco says, checking the number on his list. All the eyes in the room turn as the girl rises from her seat and steps forward. Marco watches her approach, confused at first, but then the confusion is replaced by something else entirely. He could tell from across the room that she was lovely, but when she is near enough to look him in the eyes, the loveliness, the shape of her face, the contrast of her hair against her skin evolves into something more. She is radiant. For a moment, while they look at each other, he cannot remember what he is meant to be doing, or why she is handing him a piece of paper with a number 23 written on it in his own handwriting. "This way, please," he manages to say as he takes her number and holds the door open for her. She bobs the slightest of curtsies in acknowledgement, and the lobby is abuzz with whispers before the door has fully closed behind them. The theatre is massive and ornate, with rows upon rows of plush red velvet seats, orchestra, mezzanine, and balcony spreading out from the empty stage in a cascade of crimson. It is empty save for two people seated approximately 10 rows back from the stage. Chandres Christophe Lefebvre sits with his feet propped up on the seat in front of him. Madame Anna Padva sits on his right, pulling a watch from her bag while she stifles a yawn. Marco emerges from the wing of the stage with the girl in the green dress trailing close behind him. He gestures for her to move to the center of the stage, unable to take his eyes from her as he announces her to the mostly empty theater. "Number 23, he says, before descending a small set of stairs near the proscenium and hovering by the edge of the front row, pen poised over his open notebook. Madame Padva looks up and smiles, tucking her watch back into her bag.
"What's this, then?"
Chandrish asks, not directing the question at anyone in particular. The girl does not respond. "This is number 23, Marco repeats, checking his notes to make certain the number is accurate.
"We're auditioning illusionists, my dear girl," Chandrish says rather loudly, his voice echoing through the cavernous space. "Magicians, conjurers, etc. No need for lovely assistance at this time."
"I am an illusionist, sir," the girl says. Her voice is calm and low. "I am here for your auditions."
"I see," Chandrish says, frowning as he looks the girl over slowly from head to toe.
She stands perfectly still in the center of the stage, patiently, as though she has expected such a reaction.
"Is there something wrong with that?"
Madame Padva asks.
"I am not entirely sure it is appropriate," Chandrish says, eyeing the girl thoughtfully. "After all, you're pontificating about the contortionist."
Chandrish pauses, still looking at the girl on the stage who, while comparatively elegant, does not appear particularly unusual.
"That's a different matter,"
is all he can manage as to his reasoning.
"Really, Chandrish," Madame Padva says, "we should at least let her show off her skills before arguing over the appropriateness of a female illusionist. But she has so much more sleeve to hide things up," he protests.
In response, the girl unbuttons her puff-sleeve jacket and drops it unceremoniously on the stage by her feet. Her green gown is both sleeveless and strapless, leaving her shoulders and arms completely bare, save for a long silver chain with what appears to be a silver locket around her neck. She then removes her gloves and tosses them one by one on the crumpled jacket as well. Madame Padva gives Chandrish a pointed look that is met with a sigh.
"Very well," Chandrish says. "On with it."
He gestures vaguely at Marco. "Yes, sir," Marco says, turning to address the girl. "We have a few preliminary questions before the practical demonstration. Your name, miss?" "Celia Bowen." Marco records this in his notebook.
"And your stage name?" he asks.
"I don't have a stage name," Celia says. Marco notes this as well.
"Where have you performed professionally?"
"I have never performed professionally before."
At this, Chandresh moves to interrupt, but Madame Padva stops him.
Then, with whom have you studied? Marco asks.
With my father.
Hector Bowen, Celia answers. She pauses for a moment before adding, though perhaps he is better known as Prospero the Enchanter. Marco drops his pen.
Prospero the Enchanter?
Chandras removes his feet from the chair in front of him and leans forward, staring at Celia as though he is seeing a completely different person.
Your father is Prospero the Enchanter?
Was, Celia clarifies. He passed last year.
I'm sorry for your loss, dear, Madame Padva says. But who, pray tell, is Prospero the Enchanter? Only the greatest illusionist of his generation, Chandras says. Used to book him whenever I could get my hands on him years ago now. Absolutely brilliant. Completely mesmerized every audience. Never seen anyone to match him. Never.
He would have been pleased to hear that, sir,
Celia says, her eyes briefly glancing over to the shadowed curtains at the side of the stage.
I told him as much, though I haven't seen him in ages. Got very drunk with him in a pub some years back, and he went on about pushing the boundaries of what theatre can be, inventing something more extraordinary. He probably would have loved this entire endeavour. Damned shame.
He sighs heavily, shaking his head.
Well, on with it then,
he says, leaning back in his seat and regarding Celia with a considerable amount of interest. Marco, pen in hand once more, returns to his list of questions.
Are you capable of performing without a stage?
Yes, Celia says.
Can your illusions be viewed from all angles?
Celia smiles. You are looking for someone who can perform in the midst of a crowd? She asks Chandresh. He nods.
I see, Celia says. Then, so swiftly she appears not even to move, she picks up her jacket from the stage and flings it out over the seats where, instead of tumbling down, it swoops up, folding into itself. In the blink of an eye, folds of silk are glossy black feathers, large beating wings, and it is impossible to pinpoint the moment when it is fully raven and no longer cloth. The raven swoops over the red velvet seats and up into the balcony, where it flies in curious circles.
Impressive, Madame Padva says. Unless she had him concealed in those gigantic sleeves, Chandresh mutters.
On the stage, Celia crosses closer to Marco. May I borrow that for a moment? She asks him, indicating his notebook. He hesitates before handing it to her.
Thank you, she says, returning to the center of the stage.
She barely glances at the list of questions in precise handwriting before tossing the notebook straight up into the air, where it turns end over end and the blur of fluttering paper becomes a white dove flapping its wings and taking flight in a loop around the theater. The raven caws at it from its perch in the balcony.
Ah!
Chandresh exclaims, both at the dove and the expression on Marco's face. The dove swoops back down to Celia, settling gently on her outstretched hand. She strokes its wings and then releases it back into the air. It lifts up only a few feet above her head before wings are paper once again, and it topples quickly down. Celia catches it with one hand and gives it back to Marco, whose complexion is now a few shades paler.
Thank you,
Celia says with a smile. Marco nods absently, not meeting her eyes, and quickly retreats to his corner.
Marvelous! Simply marvelous, Chandras says. This could work. This could most definitely work.
He rises from his seat and moves down the aisle, stopping to pace thoughtfully in front of the orchestra pit by the footlights.
There is the matter of costuming her,
Madame Padva calls toward him from her seat.
I had only considered formal suits. A similar sort of gown might do just as well, I suppose.
What manner of costume do you require? Celia asks.
We have a color scheme to work with, dear,
Madame Padva says.
Or lack thereof, rather. Nothing but black and white. Though on you a full black gown might be a bit too funereal.
I see, says Celia.
Madame Padva stands and moves down the aisle to where Chandrish is pacing. She whispers something in his ear, and he turns to consult with her, taking his eyes off Celia for a moment. No one is watching her except Marco, as she stands perfectly still on the stage, waiting patiently. And then, very slowly, her gown begins to change. Starting at the neckline and seeping down like ink, the green silk is turning a murky midnight black. Marco gasps. Chandresh and Madame Padva turn at the sound just in time to witness the creeping black fade into snow-bright white at the bottom of the skirt, until all evidence that the gown was ever green is gone.
"Well, that makes my job much easier,"
Madame Padva says, though she cannot conceal the delight in her eyes.
"Though I think perhaps your hair is too light a shade."
Celia shakes her head, and her brown curls deepen in hue to a near black, as glossy and ebony as the wings of her raven.
"Marvelous," Chandresh says, almost to himself.
Celia simply smiles. Chandresh leaps up to the stage, taking the small flight of stairs in only two steps. He inspects Celia's gown from every angle.
"May I?"
he asks before carefully touching the fabric of her skirt. Celia nods. The silk is undeniably black and white, the transition between the two a soft fade of grey, distinct fibres visible in the weave.
"What happened to your father, if you don't mind my prying?"
Chandresh asks, his attention still on her gown.
"I do not mind," Celia says.
"One of his tricks did not go entirely as planned."
"That's a damned shame,"
he says, stepping back.
"Miss Bowen, might you be interested in a somewhat unique employment opportunity?"
He snaps his fingers, and Marco approaches with his notebook, halting a few paces away from Celia, his stare moving from her gown to her hair and back, spending a considerable amount of time in between. Before she can respond, a caw echoes through the theatre from the raven still perched on the balcony, watching the scene in front of him curiously.
"Just a moment," Celia says.
She lifts her hand in a delicate gesture at the raven. In response, it caws again and spreads its large wings, taking flight and swooping toward the stage, gaining speed as it approaches. Descending quickly, it dives, flying directly at Celia and not wavering or slowing as it reaches the stage, but approaching at full speed. Chandresh jumps back with a start, almost falling over Marco as the raven crashes into Celia in a flurry of feathers. And then it is gone. Not a single feather remains, and Celia is once again wearing a puff-sleeve black jacket, already buttoned over her black and white gown. In the front of the orchestra, Madame Padva claps. Celia bows, taking the opportunity to retrieve her gloves from the floor.
"She's perfect,"
Chandresh remarks, pulling a cigar from his pocket.
"Absolutely perfect."
"Yes, sir," says Marco behind him, the notebook in his hand shaking slightly. The illusionists waiting in the lobby grumble when they are thanked for their time and politely dismissed. Stratagem. London, April 1886.
"She's too good to keep out in the crowd," Chandresh says. "She simply must have her own tent. We'll put the seats in a ring or something. Keep the audience right in the middle of the action."
"Yes, sir,"
Marco says, fiddling with his notebook, running his fingers over the pages that had been wings only minutes before.
"Whatever is the matter with you?"
Chandresh asks.
"You're white as a sheet."
His voice echoes through the empty theatre as they stand alone on the stage. Madame Padva, having whisked Miss Bowen off, peppering her with questions about gowns and hairstyles.
"I am fine, sir," Marco says.
You look awful,
Chandrish says, puffing on his cigar.
Go home.
Marco looks up at him, surprised.
Sir, there is paperwork that needs to be done, he protests.
Do it tomorrow. Plenty of time for such things. Tant Padva and I will take Miss Bowen back to the house for tea, and we can sort out the particulars and paperwork later. Get some rest, or have yourself a drink, or whatever it is you do.
Chandrish waves a hand at him absently, the smoke from his cigar trailing in bobbing waves.
If you insist, sir.
I do insist, and get rid of the rest of those fellows in the lobby. No need to see a bunch of suits with capes when we've already found something far more interesting. Quite attractive, too, I should think, if one's predilections run in that direction.
Indeed, sir,
Marco says, a blush creeping into his pallor. Until tomorrow, then. He nods his head in something almost like a bow, before turning gracefully on his heel and heading out to the lobby.
Didn't take you to be the easily spooked type, Marco,
Chandrish calls after him, but Marco does not turn. Marco politely dismisses the illusionists in the lobby, explaining that the position has been filled and thanking them for their time. None of them notice that his hands are shaking or that he is clutching the pen in his hands so tightly that his knuckles are white. Nor do they notice when it snaps in two within his fist, black ink seeping down his wrist. After the illusionists have departed, Marco gathers his things, wiping his ink-covered hand on his black coat. He puts on his bowler hat before he exits the theater. With every step, he grows more visibly distressed. People move out of his way on the crowded pavement. When he reaches his flat, Marco drops his bag to the floor, leaning against the door with a heavy sigh.
What's wrong?
Isabel asks from a chair next to the empty fireplace. She conceals the length of hair she has been braiding in her pocket, scowling as she knows she will have to rebraid the entire piece because her concentration was broken. It is the part she still has the most difficulty with, the concentration and focus. For now, she abandons it and watches Marco as he crosses the room to reach the bookcases lining the wall.
I know who my opponent is, Marco says, pulling armfuls of books down from their shelves and spreading them out haphazardly over tables, leaving several in messy piles on the floor.
Those remaining on the shelves collapse, a few volumes falling, but Marco does not seem to notice.
Is it that Japanese woman you were so curious about?
Isabel asks, watching as Marco's impeccable filing system falls into chaos. The flat has always been kept in perfect order, and she finds the sudden upheaval disquieting.
No, Marco says as he flips through pages. It's Prospero's daughter.
Isabel picks up a potted violet that has toppled in the wake of the falling books and places it back upon its shelf.
Prospero? She asks. The magician, the one you saw in Paris?
Marco nods.
I didn't know he had a daughter, she says.
I was unaware of that fact myself,
Marco says, discarding one book and picking up another. Chandrish just hired her to be the illusionist for the circus.
Really?
Isabel asks. Marco does not respond.
So she'll be doing what you said he did, actual magic, disguised as stage illusions. Did she do that at the audition?
Yes, she did,
Marco says without looking up from his books.
She must be very good.
She's too good,
Marco says, pulling another shelf worth of books from their resting places and moving them to the table, the violet an innocent victim once more.
This could be extremely problematic,
he says, almost to himself. A pile of notebooks slips from the table to the floor in a flurry of fluttering pages and a sound like the wings of birds. Isabel retrieves the violet again, placing it across the room.
Does she know who you are?
She asks.
I do not believe so,
Marco says.
Does this mean the circus is part of the challenge?
Isabel asks. Marco stops flipping through pages and looks up at her.
It must,
he says, before he returns his attention to the book.
That's likely why I was sent to work for Chandrish, so I would already be involved. The circus is the venue.
Is that good? Isabel asks, but Marco does not answer, lost in the flood of paper and ink again. With one hand he fidgets with the cloth of the other sleeve. A splatter of black ink stains the white cuff.
She changed the fabric, he mutters to himself. How did she change the fabric?
Isabel moves a pile of abandoned books to the desk, where her Marseille deck rests. She looks up at Marco, who is now deeply engrossed in a particular volume. She quietly spreads the cards out in a long line across the desk. Keeping her eyes on Marco, she draws a single card. She flips it over on the desk and looks down to see what her cards have to say about the matter. A man stands between two women, a cherub with bow and arrow hovering over their heads.
L'amoureux,
the lovers.
Is she pretty?
Isabel asks. Marco does not answer. She pulls another card from the line and lays it atop the first.
La Maison Dieu.
She frowns at the picture of the crumbling tower and the falling figure. She returns both cards to the deck, pushing it back into an orderly stack.
Is she stronger than you?
Isabel asks. Again Marco fails to answer, flipping through the pages of a notebook. For years he has felt reasonably well prepared. Practicing with Isabel has proved an advantage, enabling him to improve aspects of his illusions to the point where even with her familiarity, she cannot always discern what is real. But faced with his opponent, his feelings about the challenge have suddenly changed, replaced by nerves and confusion. He had half expected he would simply know what to do when the time came, and he had entertained the thought that the time might never come, that the promise of the game was something to motivate his studies and nothing more.
So the competition will begin when the circus opens, then?
Isabel asks him. He had almost forgotten she was there.
I suppose that would be logical, Marco says. I don't understand how we are meant to compete when the circus is going to travel, and I must remain in London. I shall have to do everything remotely.
I could go, Isabel says.
What?
Marco asks, looking up at her again.
You said the circus still needs a fortune teller, didn't you? I could read my cards. I haven't read for anyone but myself, but I am getting better at it. I could write you letters when the circus is away. It would give me some place to go, if you're not supposed to have me here while you play your game.
I'm not sure that's a good idea, Marco says, though he cannot articulate why. He had never considered the possibility of involving Isabel in his life outside the bounds of the flat. He had been keeping her separate from Chandresh and the circus, both to have something of his own, and because it seemed appropriate, especially given his instructor's vague advice about the matter.
Please, Isabel says, this way I can help you.
Marco hesitates, glancing down at his books. His thoughts remain preoccupied with the image of the girl from the theater.
It will help you be closer to the circus, Isabel continues, and it will give me something to do for the duration of your challenge. When it's done, I can come back to London.
I'm not even certain how the challenge is going to work, Marco says.
But you're certain that I can't stay here during it?
She asks. Marco sighs. They have discussed it before, not in any great detail, but enough to establish that when the game began, she would have to leave.
I am already so busy working for Chandresh, and I will need to focus on the competition without distraction,
he says, using his instructor's choice of word from an order disguised as a suggestion. He is not certain which option bothers him more, involving Isabel in the game or relinquishing the one relationship in his life that has not been dictated for him.
This way, I wouldn't be a distraction. I'd be helping, Isabel says. And if you're not supposed to have help, well, I'd only be writing you letters. What's wrong with that? It seems like a perfect solution to me.
I could arrange for you to meet with Chandresh, Marco suggests.
You could convince him to hire me, couldn't you?
Isabel asks.
If he needs convincing.
Marco nods, still not entirely certain about the idea, but almost desperate for some kind of strategy. A tactic to use in dealing with his newly revealed opponent. He turns her name over and over in his mind.
What is Prospero's daughter named?
Isabel asks, as though she can tell what he is thinking.
Bowen, Marco says. Her name is Celia Bowen.
It's a pretty name,
Isabel says.
Is something wrong with your hand?
Marco looks down, surprised to find that he has been holding his right hand in his left, unconsciously stroking the empty space where a ring was once burned into his skin.
No,
he says, picking up a notebook to occupy his hands.
It's nothing.
Isabel seems satisfied with the response, lifting a pile of fallen books from the floor and stacking them on the desk. Marco is relieved that she does not have the skill to pull the memory of the ring from his mind. Fire and light. You step into a bright, open courtyard surrounded by striped tents. Curving pathways along the perimeter lead away from the courtyard, turning into unseen mysteries dotted with twinkling lights. There are vendors traversing the crowd around you, selling refreshments and oddities, creations flavored with vanilla and honey, chocolate and cinnamon. A contortionist in a sparkling black costume twists on a platform nearby, bending her body into impossible shapes. A juggler tosses globes of black and white and silver high into the air, where they seem to hover before falling again into his hands, his attentive spectators applauding, all bathed in glowing light. The light emanates from a large bonfire in the center of the courtyard. As you walk closer, you can see that it sits in a wide black iron cauldron, balanced on a number of clawed feet. Where the rim of a cauldron would be, it breaks into long strips of curling iron, as though it has been melted and pulled apart like taffy. The curling iron continues up until it curls back into itself, weaving in and out amongst the other curls, giving it the cage-like effect. The flames are visible in the gaps between and rising slightly above. They are obscured only at the bottom, so it is impossible to tell what is burning, if it is wood or coal or something else entirely. The flames are not yellow or orange, but white as snow as they dance. Hidden Things. Concord, Massachusetts, October 1902. The arguments over Bailey's future began early and occur frequently, though at this point they often devolve into repetitive phrases and tense silences. He blames Caroline for starting it, even though the raising of the issue was the fault of his maternal grandmother. Bailey is much more fond of his grandmother than of his sister, so he leaves the blame squarely on Caroline. Had she not given in, he would not have to fight as hard. It was one of their grandmother's requests, disguised as a suggestion, one which seemed innocuous enough, that Caroline attend Radcliffe College. Caroline seemed intrigued by the idea through the entire length of tea in the cushioned, flower-wallpapered calm of their grandmother's Cambridge parlour. But any resolve she might have had about the matter disappeared as soon as they were back in Concord, and their father's word came down.
Absolutely not.
Caroline accepted this with little more than a fleeting pout, deciding that it would probably be too much work, and she did not particularly care for the city anyway. Besides, Millie was engaged, and there was a wedding to plan, a subject Caroline found far more interesting than her own education. And that was that. Then came the response from Cambridge, the grandmotherly decree that this was acceptable, but Bailey would be going to Harvard, of course. This one was not a request disguised as anything. This was pure demand. Finance-based protestations were crushed before they could be raised by the clear statement that his tuition would be taken care of. The argument started before Bailey's opinion was even asked.
"I would like to go," he said, when there came a pause long enough to fit the words in. "You're taking over the farm," was his father's response.
The easy thing to do would be to let the issue drop and raise it again later, especially considering Bailey is not quite 16 and there is a substantial interim before either option will occur. Instead, and he is not entirely certain why, he keeps the subject alive, bringing it up as often as possible, pointing out that he could always go and return to the farm after the fact, that 4 years is not a terribly long time.